This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hi there, everyone, and thank you so much, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. For those who follow this program, you know that I'm always looking for true nonprofits out there that are doing good things. In fact, I have a reverse sponsorship program here at Time Signatures, and I tell you about each one of them, or I should say one of them each and every time we record an episode. Today on Time Signatures, I'm pleased to introduce you all to a gentleman who started a 501c3 back in 2014 with a mission that, quote, seeks to shine the light of awareness on musicians who might not otherwise be heard. Fast forward just over 10 years, and Little Village Foundation has accomplished precisely, or is accomplishing precisely, what our guest set out to do. By my numbers, 78 releases and 66 artists as of right now. So for those of you who think you may not know the artists that are recording and being released through Little Village, you better think again. I'd like to welcome our guest, a man who has spent four decades in the music business, earning multiple Grammy rewards along the way, plus some platinum and gold records. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Pugh, welcome to Time Signatures. What an honor. Glad to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you taking the time to be here. And Jim, one of the hallmarks of Time Signatures is that we are in the business of preserving the history of the blues one story at a time. So I would love to have you start with how you got involved in the world of music.
Well, I grew up in suburban Chicago, and me and my friends, we all had older brothers and sisters that went places like the University of Chicago and elsewhere. And that was really by my, I'm 71. So, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was kind of the folk scare in going on. I call it the folk scare, but in that sort of embraced blues. And that was, I think, the first kind of collegiate, white collegiate wave, blues wave that occurred, you know, Muddy Waters at Newport. So, at a relatively young age, like 11 or 12 or something like that, me and my friends had our brothers and sisters' records because they were listening to stuff. Started out with Paul Butterfield, and very quickly we realized that there was a lot of the music we were listening to it was made originally by people like the Rolling Stones. You look at a Rolling Stones record and you go, that's Alan Wolfe, Chester Burnett, wait a minute, he's right down the street, you know? So, and it was sort of the absurdity of it. There was a magazine, there was a newspaper in England that we used to get that the British are so fanatical. They listed, it was a blues magazine, and I can't remember, it still exists. And it listed who played where in Chicago as if people were going to go from London to 63rd Hillstead. But we did. We'd take the L, and most of the time almost all the time you get thrown out, but we'd find places to go. So from an early age, a young teenager, and I had taken piano lessons, which seems like everybody did back then. And I started wanting to play like Otis Spann or Memphis Slim or Sunnyland Slim. You know, I'd seen those people. So, and a real turning point was in 1969, they had the first Chicago Blues Festival in Grant Park.
Yes, sir.
Went to that, and it was kind of like around the same time they had Ann Arbor. My parents wouldn't let me go to Ann Arbor because I don't know why, but maybe because I was 15 or something. my friends did, but I didn't. But I went to the Chicago Blues Festival, and that was similar in some ways, that it went all the way from Victoria Spivey to Muddy Waters and Otis Rush and Johnny Hort, you know, like all kinds of people that it really exposed me to it. And I was very much committed by early high school, I was very committed to it. So that's kind of how it started. And then it kind of went from there.
Well, Jim, I want to bring you back to the age of 14, if you could. According to the interview that I was reading, you made a phone call to the legendary Willie Dixon, hoping to hire Coco Taylor for your freshman dance. I have to hear this story, man. The floor is yours.
Well, let's see if I tell this the right way. What it was, when I was a freshman in high school, they said, you know, you got to have an activity. I mean, what do you want to do? Well, I didn't really want to do anything, but I said, okay, I'll be on the dance committee. And they said, okay, well, do you want to hire a band to play at the freshman dance? And I went, sure. And at that point, I mean, starting somewhere in grade school, you know, I'd been going to Jazz Record Mart, to Del Mar Records, and buying records from Bob Kester. So I called him up and went, you know, I want to hire a dance. And he said, well, Willie Dixon manages Coco Taylor. We could call him up. And it was a three-way call. And I hired, you know, and people say, well, Jim, that was the most coolest thing in the world. And I go, it really kind of wasn't, because I mean, it was like, you know, Willie set it up and he was very friendly. But at some point I had to go like, okay, now you talk to Eunice Jackson's mother. She'll tell you about, you know, there was somebody's mother. It was like, you know, it was really square. But anyway, so, and they came and played. And then after that, I got Otis Rush. And then after that, I hired parts of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. And they said, don't hire any more music. You know, I mean, it was all because Bob Kester had, you know, a lot of different genres. I mean, he had Dixieland, and he had trad jazz, and he had, you know, it was Chicago soul jazz, and I got into Genius and all this stuff. And he also had sort of this avant-garde of the WCM. So anyway, and of course, blues artists. So there was this sort of natural progression into what eventually scared the shit out of suburban people in Chicago at that time. So, and well, I guess, the punchline to the story, that's right, there's a beginning and a middle and an end to the story. Years later, and actually this is my favorite part, but years later, I was at a blues festival in Santa Cruz with Robert Cray, and I was walking across the back of the stage. It was an outdoor thing, and I was walking across the back of the stage, and leaning against the fence, there were all these like West Coast blues, you know, authorities. And I could name who they were, but it was all kinds of people that you probably would know of. And I, talking to this older black woman, and as I was walking by, Robert's manager, Mike Kappa, said, you know, Jim, I want you to meet Willie Dixon's widow. You know, and he goes, Mrs. Dixon, this is Jim Pugh. He talked to Willie on the phone when he was 14 to hire Coco Taylor. And right when Mike said that, and I shook the woman's hand, this guy, Dick Waterman. Dick Waterman stepped literally in front of me and kind of stuck his ass in my face and kind of went, yeah, we don't want to hear about that. We don't want to hear about Junior Wells when I went to, you and I and Willie went to see Junior Wells at Turner's. We don't, you know, we don't. So, and I was, at this point, was used to sort of being asked to step out of the photograph. And
sure.
I just, sure, whatever. And I turned around and walked away at what was, I thought, really rude. And as I was walking away, I heard this woman go, Jim, excuse me, Jim. And I turned around, and it was really, you know, in this business we call show, but it was like this woman, Willie Dixon's widow, took her hand and pushed, you can see like that, pushed him out of the way and said, I answered the phone that day. And all these blues authorities, Chris Strachwitz and John Goddard and all these people went, oh my God, who is this geek that, you know, predates us, you know? So anyway, it was a real nice moment. And a favorite story that I tell over and over again. And I don't think I've amplified it too much, but that's kind of what it was.
No, I absolutely love that story. When I was reading it, I says, I got to ask him, I've got to have this story. Just absolutely have to. Now I'm going to fast forward to 1969, the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, which you already mentioned you weren't allowed to go to. But you did attend the 69 Chicago Blues Fest in Grant Park, which at the time, I believe, was put on by Willie. And Billy Branch tells the story that that's where he fell hopelessly in love with the blues. and actually became affiliated with Willie shortly thereafter with the Chicago Blues All-Stars. But talk about that event just a little bit. I mean, you guys really had a show over there, didn't you?
Well, it was free, and it was, I can't, I've read about it since then, but it was a free event in Grant Park, and it started like at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it went till dark. And the last act was Muddy Waters, and it was the period of Muddy Waters where they were kind of like wearing dashikis in their hair, you know, like the kind of Electric Mud. They didn't play, I don't remember what year Electric Mud came out, but it was sort of like, and there was an interesting thing because I was suburban and white and dumb. I mean, I didn't know much. how could you? But there was a fair, the Black Panther movement in Chicago at that time was relatively big. And there was, you know, there was a lot of people, like Big Joe Williams came out and they kind of like booed him off the stage waiting for what they thought was some people. He got heckled because he played solo in front of 10,000 people. Well, that doesn't work, but we were close, you know, and it was great. I mean, I'm trying to think of who else. Well, there was Lucille Spann, and that's the only time I saw Otis Spann was with her. He had left Muddy and was doing a band with her.
Okay.
There was Johnny Shines. There was who's the guy who played Johnny Young, the guy who played mandolin. It was probably a lot of people that went to Ann Arbor. You didn't go, but you probably knew people that went.
Oh yeah, know a few.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, actually, I think the Ann Arbor Blues Fest that year was very much, I mean, kind of like there were a lot of people that went. I mean, it was a historic thing. It was like one of those baseball games that 80,000 people said they were there. But I you know. that was very much, you know, and I had seen people like Otis Rush and Magic Sam and Luther Allison. I always thought that all of them were great. I really thought Luther Allison was going to be, he somehow changed as I think he was slightly tormented, but as was Otis Rush. There were a lot of just really, really talented people. And from that, I sort of, because I played blues, and then I tried to start to play, learn standards and play, you know, and I went to a fair amount of music. There were places that would let underage people in Chicago. So I drifted. Well, ask me another question.
No. This, I'm loving these stories. I really am. At what point in your life did you determine that a life in the music business was in the cards for you, Jim?
Probably about fourth grade.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
I mean, I you know, my mother was a piano player and she said, you know, Jim, if you learn all the Big Ten fight songs, you'll be popular at parties. Yeah, right. I learned James Taylor songs and Look Forlorn. That seemed to work pretty well. No, I from an early age, I liked performing. I liked playing music in front of people. And it was something that I'm kind of basically self-taught. And I've kind of arrived at what I know sort of by sheer luck. And I guess you could call that style, for a lack of a better word. But no, early on. Yeah, that was real cool.
Now I'm going to have to hop around a little bit because we'd be here all day if we talked about all your accomplishments through the years. But at the age of 21, you joined a band comprised of members of Sly Stone's band in Cold Blood. Yeah. Talk about that opportunity and how did it present itself to you?
There was an agent in San Francisco that was involved in this band being put together. It was kind of a super band in some ways at that time. And they auditioned everybody. I mean, and I auditioned and I don't know how, but I ended up getting it. And I did that for too long. I mean, the problem, you know, happens with a lot of bands is that you might have initial success, but the sophomoric blues, sticking around to the end of things that don't, you know, it's such a crapshoot. But early on, they had, I think for about a week, it was a top 20 hit. And there was a couple of people from Cold Blood. There was a couple of people. Well, there was Jerry that was from Sly and the Family Stone, and there was another
Okay.
song player who played with them. And there were people from Andre Crouch, you know. So it was sort of this blend of, at best, that's what I tell people. I said at best, it sounded like a cross between Led Zeppelin and Tower of Power, and at worst, it sounded like Pablo Cruz. We didn't really, it was problematic, but they had a lot behind them, and I made records in Los Angeles at a really early age. I spent a lot of time learning how to, I mean, not learning, but being around the recording process. It just kind of naturally sort of, I learned something, I guess.
Okay. Well,
And
Jim,
then,
you said that you actually knew Robert Cray for a while before joining his band.
oh, sure. Yeah.
Any fun stories along the way from that period when you were building that relationship? And I'm assuming that you came on after Curtis left.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was 1989 that I joined, and Curtis had left the
Okay.
year before. Yeah, no, I knew. Well, we all used to play at this club in Berkeley, Larry Blake's, which was a blues club that, from there I had worked, and the band, the Rat Band, ended up at one point being, I think everybody in the Rat Band was the Robert Cray band for a while. And yeah, I mean, about how I knew Robert, I mean, it was really hilarious. There was one time late at night, really late, we were sitting around, and he had just done the movie, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. What was the Chuck Berry movie? You know, the one with Keith Richards?
I don't have that
Oh,
one on me. I'm sorry.
okay. Well, there's a movie about like a live performance thing that's got everybody in it. That's Chuck Berry and Keith Richards, and it's kind of a
Okay.
famous biopic. And Robert is in it, and Etta James was in it. So I'm
Oh, wow.
sitting there, and there's a bunch of people if you look at them. Well, anyway, he came to Blake's, and we sat there and had a few drinks. And after a while, he goes, "You know, I did this movie in St. Louis, with Keith Richards and Chuck Berry, and Etta kept talking about you." I said, "Oh, well, that's nice." No, she really was talking about you. And I went, "Well, okay. Like, you know, what's going on?" Somehow he was implying that I was having, you know, that it was more than just music. And I went, "Yeah." But anyway, so we had a good time. And actually, the best I ever saw of Robert Cray, the best that I ever saw him, was at Larry Blake's. It was one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. There was something about the way those four people played together that was just spectacular. And it kind of, in a way, it never was better than that. I mean, it probably was, but not to me, you know. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. I don't, he's, and also he kind of pisses me off because he has a tremendous amount of talent. He's seen as being standoffish, but he's painfully, clinically shy. But he's somebody who's capable of just, there's no, and he's so nice, he will not assert himself in any way. I mean, if I could play and sing and write songs like that, I would be the biggest asshole in the world. I mean, you have to speak up for yourself.
He was one of the only people that have actually turned me down for an interview through the PR people, and I wondered why, and
Oh
that
no,
makes sense. That
yeah,
makes sense.
it's.
And isn't
It's
it amazing that people that have that kind of gift on stage and engage people in masses like that, there's more than a few of them out there that are, as you state, clinically shy when they're
Well,
off.
and I think honestly, and I mean, I don't suppose he'll hear, but if he did, were to hear it, you know, I mean it sincerely. I don't think he likes people looking at him, whether they're on stage or not, whether he's on stage or not. And it's a pretty weird thing if you play and sing every and wrote every song, damn near every song, and you don't like people looking at you makes you slightly uncomfortable. He's a beautiful guy. He lives right over, he lives about a mile from me. We're
Okay.
still, we're not friendly, but I mean, that's when I see him, you know, it's great. He's very, I did it for about 10 years too long. And I should have, but I'm grateful to him for being able to raise a family and do all the things that I did. But
Indeed, indeed. And that's a good springboard for the next question here. Turning the page, following your 25-year stint with Robert, you went through a long period of soul searching, according to what I read, which ultimately ended up with the formation of the Little Village Foundation. I would love to hear a little bit about that.
well, when I stopped playing with Robert, I'd sort of been planning that this was going to happen. I mean, there are reasons why. Well, anyway, without going into the whole thing, I got unemployment and I got severance, and I was able to be okay for a while before I had to figure out what I was going to do. 6 months, a year, something like that. And I was happy that when I left, I did find work that I like. I went to Europe and worked with Syl Johnson. I did a record with Tracy Nelson. Was staying busy. But in terms of Little Village, I mean, or myself, is that I was 60. So, and I went, nobody wants a 60-year-old piano player. And not only that, I don't want to get in the back of a bus and ride to New York from here anymore. I'm done with that. So I had to figure out something else that I wanted to do. And somebody pointed to me out, this, I guess, is the long version, but somebody pointed out to me, they said, well, find the things you have a passion about. And then this guy's a friend of mine said, I'll help you figure out a way to make it into a business. And so I had a job at a volunteer job at a botanic garden shoveling mulch. And I mean, like, semi-trailer full of mulch and a wheelbarrow and a pitchfork and me. I did like 40 acres. And I was really,
Wow.
I was trying to physically work my way out of being terrified. Just because I had kids and I had a mortgage and it was bleak. These kinds of gigs don't come around very often, not to me anyway. So I came up with the three things I like. I like music. I have a passion for music. I have a passion for helping people in small ways. I mean, I really do like, not like United Way, but in a real small, helping with the groceries, helping somebody across the street, small things. I like that. And I like diversity. I am living in the Bay Area and the kind of, and trying to survive as a musician, Oakland and San Francisco. I've played in every kind of circumstance that you can imagine. And I've been supported by people. You know, I've stayed in people's houses and you know, been friends with their kids and all kinds of stuff to where I'm comfortable in, you know, diverse circumstances, what would be called diverse circumstances. I like that. So I kind of combined all of them into the idea of Little Village, of helping musicians a little bit, of kind of having. Originally, it was sort of suggested that it should just be blues recordings. And I didn't want to do that. I really think that, and it's been proven, I think that people who listen to mariachi music would like blues, because we get together and do these shows where there's four or five different genres of music, and people, it cross-pollinates, and people, the audience from one becomes the audience of another. And it's, you know, I think that blues music, and it's a longer conversation, but I think blues music, the genre, really does have a future. But the problem is everybody's looking in the same place to for an audience. And you know, it's kind of the same way as it was in Newport in 1960 or 65, whenever it was. I think Muddy played there in 60 and Paul Butterfield played there in 65. Was it 65 with Dylan? Well, anyway, you know, that it's possible through a folk genre. When we've done had blues acts play at folk festivals, I like that. And other kinds of music festivals. I mean, but blues has gotten a bad name for a bunch of different reasons. And I think that there is a way, there is an audience for this music, but it's not for the people that bought It's My Life, Baby, you know, or Who Demand Blues. Those people that bought all the, you know, blues records, they're going to buy a lot of them. And also, it's aging out. So they got to figure out how to get an audience that does it. So that was part of the parameters of Little Village. So if you've recorded from 9 to 92 or whatever, 102, we've this huge age, span, and diverse, like 4, 5, 6 languages. We are blues-centric. I know more about blues music than I do anything else. And we have lately recorded younger people that play blues, and it's worked well. And we look as, Jim, I'll tell you, we look as a metric of success. If somebody does a record for Little Village and then goes somewhere else and makes a record, well, typically that would be prohibited in a regular record company. But we're not only do we encourage it, we see that as a sign. I show that to donors. I go, Chris Kane made this record for Little Village, and then he went and made this record for Alligator. DK Harrell made this record for Little Village, and then he made a record for Alligator. And there have been other labels too. I mean, there's certainly there's Kevin Burt, and there's Candace Ivory, she went, so there's a lot of different things that go into what we're trying to do and how we look at it. And it flies in the face of the artist gets everything. They owe nothing and they own everything. There's no time limit. It's not 7 1-year options. It's all in favor of the artist. And we are limited. I mean, we're not a real record company. We don't administer publishing. We don't take publishing. I don't have, Bruce has got 22 people working for him full time. I've got one. Guess who that is? Me. So, that's kind of what, and I've been really lucky because there are people that I've surrounded myself with and they just kind of appeared. Kid Anderson's amazing. Charlie Hunter. He's amazing. And there's 2 or 3 other producers that I use, and they're PR people, as you know, Kevin Johnson and he does a great job for us. And there's 2 or 3 other publicists we use for different genres. Blues music, I'll tell you, I've realized because everybody says, oh, it's, 0.008% of the record buying public buys blues. But you know what? Blues music is great in the way that there are, half a dozen blues magazines. There's a blues society in every town in America. These people are all loyal. There's a following. There are people doing well. Now, does it cross over into big numbers? Maybe. Sometimes. I mean, it depends on what you call blues. I mean, I would be curious to know how you define blues, but
I guess I always define blues, and this is something that I've formulated over the last 12 to 18 months. The blues is a buffet to me. You've got your basic blues genre, and then you've got little offshoots that may be Memphis blues, Delta blues, country blues, right down the line. A lot of people will look and say, well, I don't consider Joe Bonamassa blues. Well, because he happens to put rock with his blues or blues with his rock, look what the man has done for the genre, during COVID, helping to support these musicians that couldn't get out and had problems financially. He helped a lot of those people. And I've known a couple of the bands that he helped. But I think that blues, the actual recipe, if you will, is subjective to the person,
one of the things that's interesting, we did a record with John Jubu Smith, who, if you ask, and I have, if you ask, Kingfish or DK Harrell or who else? Mac McDonald. And then some other people, if you ask them who their favorite guitar player is, I will tell you, they say Jubu. And if you ask Tommy Castro, what does he think of Jubu? He goes, who's Jubu? There's a disconnect that goes on. And we're sort of trying to, and now is it straight up blues? Well, yeah, there's a, if you listen to the record, there's a lot of, sure, he's a quartet guitar player, and I'm a huge fan of quartet music. In fact, I'm trying to, any way I can, I'm trying to talk the Blues Foundation into including quartet music in the BMAs, because I quartet music, B.B. King was a quartet guitar player before he was a blues guitar player. It really is, if you want to find the roots of the music, it obviously goes back to before the Civil War, but it also it includes quartet music very much. So anyway, I mean it's I have an optimism. I have a certain amount of optimism about blues. I don't think because everybody pretty much now is dead that the genre is over. I think it's going to continue. And I think that there, once the audience dies, that includes me, there's going to be another audience. And I think that if you look at it, I'm so fucking opinionated, but if you look at about every 20 or 25 years, it comes back into the psyche, the consciousness of the American public. I mean, it happened that way with Butterfield and them in 65, and it happened again in the 80s with Cray, and I think it happened more recently with Joe Bonamassa and their other people, Kingfish. So
Sure.
it's
Well,
possible.
I'll tell you. You were talking about the various audiences that you could put together for a show. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Fillmore West when you started talking about that. The shows that used to be at the Fillmore West in the 60s and 70s very much were like that, where they had the mix of different genres together.
Oh yeah. I mean, I know I was too young to have experienced that, but the idea of these drastically diverse circumstances, and it was a very much more open audience. No, you're right. Very
Oh,
much so.
yeah. One of the things that I love about your label is that it's not just about the blues, Jim. In addition to blues, you've produced albums for soul singers, indigenous people, spoken word, folk, and country. Honest, heartfelt, and close to the ground is how it's described, according to your website. And I think that honestly, it's a pretty good recipe for what you're doing, don't you? Would you agree?
Yeah, well, I think that there is, I mean, if it is blues sort of centric, we are. And if you're interested in the future of things, music, on the website I wrote that somewhere is that we're only really hearing the music that's being, we're only seeing what's being shown, right? It's a conspiracy thing. But I think it's true that Little Village in some ways really reflects the way America sounds like, what it sounds like. And it's not, what you hear on XM radio on channel one or channel two. There are other things out there. So, and I'm not suggesting that Little Village should, I'm not in trying to take over the music business. It's just a small thing. It's like helping the lady across the street,
Sure.
and that way, and that, I have, I'll tell you, Jim, in the last few years, I've started, and I sort of lost my way because I started doing artists that were more established. I mean, I get calls all the time, and sometimes there have been people who've looked under the hood that are, I mean, legitimate mainstream artists who say, I want to do a record for Little Village. Well, it doesn't really work for people that are a big deal. And I've done that lately, and I'm sort of going back to really people who exist totally under the radar. Because it doesn't really work for people that have careers, people who own houses, people that are in their 70s.
Well, that's not the foundational purpose of Little Village either, is it?
I know. Well, there was a strategy at one point that was expressed that, a known artist could bring attention to Little Village, and so
True,
that
true.
but it is more I sort of betrayed it. And now I'm going to try to I'm going to try to get back to it. It's harder, you know. It's because some of these people, it got into a thing where, you know, I started out doing 4 records, and this last year we did 14. And I mean, it's like, so some of these people I know, you know.
Sure.
I mean, to actually go out and find people and build trust. I mean, I've been doing, you know, Jim, I'm really into Historic Black College and University, HBCU marching bands. So I've gone to Grambling and I've gone to Jackson State, and I try and talk these marching bands into doing like a video or doing a documentary about the way that and they just, they think I'm nuts. Trust building. I mean, to really walk into a circumstance where you don't know anybody and nobody knows you, it involves a lot of work. And I don't, you know, I've got an energy. I mean, I've done it to a degree with Mexican music in the Valley, you know, mariachi. That's a certain, there's a suspicion gospel music. People are naturally suspicious of anything that looks too good to be true. They figure I'm ripping off, or it's my money, or, you know, I'm making a living from this, but it's blues money. It's the same. Do you play?
I do not.
Well, because it's the same thing as, like, you know, I'm not getting rich, but I'm getting along. So,
sure.
There is, things are good, but I need to kind of get back to the way that it was, and it's time consuming. So in this coming year, we're not going to do 14. We're going to do 6 or 7 or so. Hopefully.
Take a little step back. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Jim.
Be a little bit more committed to the artists than rather just putting them out there. So.
Sure. Jim, speaking solely of the blues for this question, I have to say I'm impressed. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. At the list of musicians that you've already worked with over the last 10 years. There's a couple surprises in there, as we just discussed, Terry Hank, Kyle Rowland, who came out of Sacramento, Curtis Delgado, Kid Anderson, and Lisa Anderson. Yes, that Kid Anderson. But some of the freshest faces on the scene, as you alluded to just a few moments ago, including DK Harrell, Sam Mac McDonald. And I have to tell you something, man. From the first song of Mac McDonald's album, if I close my eyes, I swear to God, I was sitting at Sun Studios in 1956. It's that damn good. And the whole album is that damn good. Where'd you find this kid?
Kid, I heard about it first from Kid, but just because I hear about it. But then he was on the blues cruise, and I met him at the IBC. I'm a judge in the IBC, and I've done that for years.
Okay.
And that's where I found DK Harrell. He finished third, which was a joke. I mean, yeah, I could tell you that story. It's weird. But, so I look around. I mean, I go, a lot of these people, Mac McDonald he's got an amazing, he's definitely going to go, he's going to be a metric for Little Village because he's going somewhere else. I mean, and he wanted to do these people, it's the same thing with DK. They want to do a record with Little Village. You know, I'm not, it's not my good looks and sparkling personality or the deal. It's just that it's kind of like, it's a certain level of trust building. I'm not out to, exploit people. I don't think I have,
I would say not. I mean, you just got done telling us that everything that they make from this is theirs. They keep their rights. They can come back to you and order more CDs at a greatly reduced rate. I would assume they're greatly reduced at that price.
Well, the way that it works is they get 1,000. It has been, now we got a different combination of things, but it has been 1,000 CDs. We actually print 1,250 and we mail out 250 for promo. And which I do, and it's a lot of stamps to lick. The 1,000 they get, and I pay the royalty. If there's mechanical royalties, I pay that by licenses. If there's cover songs, and then after that, they're on their own to buy. They can buy more. They could actually release the record somewhere else. They can do whatever they want because they own it. Little Village has never sold a CD. We never sold it because we don't own the content.
That's incredible.
It's an interesting trick because anybody who, because people have said, well, you know, Jim, you should take 10%. And I go, no, because the goodwill we're going to earn by not taking anything is going to be worth more than the 10%. And it's true because a lot of people, they look at me and they just go, I don't trust him. But then when they hear the circumstances of what it is, it's so clearly the money doesn't come to Little Village. The money, the way that this works, goes directly to the artist. So far, so good. You know, and honestly, in 70-something releases, excuse me.
Bless you.
I haven't gotten one hate letter yet. And I know, talking to Bruce, he says he's got a drawer full of cease and desist letters. And I haven't. Maybe I will now, but I haven't so far. You
know. So. Jim, as you look over the last 10 years, I mean, there's seemingly no end in sight. How does it feel knowing that this incredible label and foundation has been responsible for so many pieces of great music for many genres?
You know, I get asked that as if I should be proud or I'm grateful. That's for sure. I'm grateful. But, you know, sure. Like it goes back to Jim, I had a passion for this. This is really a passion. And if it's a passion, it's not. And there it's become work. I mean, and there are things that I'm getting grumpy. I've become a grumpy old man. And maybe I owe anyone, but I'm really starting to look. I wasn't this way. And then there's various reasons for that. It's a lot of work, and also there's a lot of demands and stuff. But I'm very, very grateful, and it's just like playing, you know, Rocket 88 by James Cotton. I mean, it's just like it's no big deal. It's no big deal to me to play, and it's no big deal to have done this and found these art. It's kind of an extension of the way that I've always lived. I mean, in some ways, a track record, which I don't flex that much. I've played kind of, I don't know if there's anybody who's played with as many people as I have. It's ridiculous. But I mean, and that's the thing that a lot of these people on this label, they're people that I either know directly or I know indirectly. You know, so, you know, it's fun. I'm having a great time. You know.
That's beautiful. I have to tell you, as I was preparing for this interview, there were so many different directions that I could have gone because the well is so deep when it comes to what you've done as a musician and people you've worked with and collaborated with and recorded with. And I love getting the stories that you shared with me today. But I wanted to talk about Little Village because to me, Little Village is the story of the day and it really needs to be shared and people need to learn more about you. I want to read a quote to you real quick. It's across the room from me, so please forgive me as I look. Steve Vai said, "Everyone is a genius when they find what they love and throw themselves into it without any excuses." I don't consider myself a genius, but that's what I've done with Time Signatures. I think you're very much in the same vein. Would you argue that at all?
Oh, when you say Steve Vai, I immediately think something else. I think that I've always been short on talent and big on commitment. I throw myself, you know, and I think you have to be willing to, you know, fail and make mistakes. Make a
yes,
fool
sir.
Of myself. I certainly have, you know.
Look at me. I got a face for radio, man.
Oldest line in show business. But, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, one of the things that, like I said, when I stopped playing with Cray and started doing Little Village, I really tried to focus on what I wanted to have happen. And I learned the thing to do is not think about what you don't want to have happen, you know, and that, you know, it was just one step after another. I've had the help of a tremendous number of people. And I think part of it is the formula of Little Village is kind of bulletproof in that nobody's being exploited,
yes, sir,
being taken advantage of. And I try to pay people, you know, for sessions and for publicists and everything. I try to pay people just a little bit more than they might want, you know.
That's rough. Well, Jim, yeah. Where can we send folks to learn more about Little Village, especially those maybe wanting to purchase some of the great music that you offer there? Because I know, as you said, all the money goes to the artist, but where can we send folks to do that?
Well, you can go to littlevillagefoundation.com, and there is an artist for every release. There's an artist page, and it's got buttons that you can go to, buy buttons that you can go to the various places. We used to have a relationship with Amazon, but that changed. Now we do, we sell CDs through Port Merch, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but they actually do everybody from Bonnie Raitt to Sting.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them, yes.
And then it's on 22 digital platforms that you can,
wow,
everything from Spotify to, you know, so that's, you know, I should say, Jim, because I get asked this, you know, I mean, I went through with one artist, they would have people call me up and go, you know, what's your European distribution? And I go, look, first of all, I don't know the last time I saw a record store. So there is no European distribution. I said, I'm trying to get my artists reviewed in the New York Times. You know, I'm trying to get them someplace that they haven't been. And I could care less whether they're end capped in, you know, in Belgium, which is what, you know, the first thing you see when you walk in the record store. I said, I just don't do that. So there are a lot, you know, we are a little bit harder to find. But the whole intention of the record label from the beginning was, you get 1,000 CDs and you go and do a gig and you sell 10 CDs. Well, if you sell them for, you know, $10, that's money you put in your pocket. That's a, you know, was it 1,000% profit? It's total profit. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, is really to sell it at, that the artist sells it themselves at venues, because that is still the number one purchase point for music. Well, I mean, obviously streaming has replaced it, but in terms of to the artists, and you'll hear artists talk about it all the time, don't stream it, buy my CD, you know. So
one of the things that I do, as I alluded to early in the program, is I have my reverse sponsorships. And one of the things that I do with my reverse sponsorships is I talk about the factoid that I ran into several months ago, that it takes 5,000 streams to equal the cash value of one CD sale at $20. So I've made it a personal mission for myself to buy before I stream, if at all possible. I'll download it off Amazon if I can find it. Whatever the you know, Bandcamp or any of these services that you can find them to buy from, it's better for me to support the musician, because I like the live music. I don't know about you, but I love going to blues festivals in the summertime and getting people touring in the fall and winter and different things. So we owe it to them. If we want to have this out there, we need to support the artist, period, end of discussion.
Well, and you know, the thing is, you're absolutely right, Jim. And the thing is to keep in mind, and this is a thing that is a factor in Little Village, is that if you drive the cost down far enough, you know, you don't have to sell that many to make more money. So if you sell 1,000 CDs, now I can't do the math in my head, but if you sell 1,000 CDs of your music, you're going to be much farther. I mean, I've had artists, and I won't say DK Harrell, there is Christine. They say that they'll put their records, they'll still sell their Little Village records, because the profit margin is enormous compared
well, of
to
course.
What they have to. Yeah, well,
it's
I
a
have
no
an amazing
brainer, man.
I have amazing grasp of the obvious, but I mean, it says something that the artist, you know, in Chris's case, like 5 or 6 years later, he's still selling it and still buying more. He's buying, you know, so it works.
As I said, it's a no-brainer, man. And for people that are watching and listening right now under the sound of my voice, go to the website. We're going to make sure that we put it in the information section of this episode. Okay. Make your tax-deductible donation today. $5, $10, $50, $500 or more, it doesn't matter. I urge you to make a donation because it's worth it to support. And we're not supporting Jim Pugh. We're supporting the Little Village Foundation. And I think that's an important disconnect. I really do. But Jim, I want you to know how much I appreciate your time today. Anytime you need to promote an album, if you have a push to raise funds for Little Village, simply reach out to me and we will give you a microphone and get it scheduled. How's that sound?
Oh, I appreciate that very much. I appreciate that very much.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Jim Pugh, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.